Hello, and welcome to Can't Make This Shit Up. I'm Cassie, a true crime enthusiast.
And I'm Mark, her dad, a true crime professional, currently a traffic homicide detective in South Florida.
And we hope you guys enjoy. Okay, so today we're going to wrap up our Al Capone episode. And we, of course, have a question at the end, too. So,
excellent.
Last time we left off, Al Capone had purchased his property in Miami on Palm Island.
Palm Island, yep.
So, although Al Capone was enjoying his time in Miami, he was still keeping a tight leash on what went on with the outfit back in Chicago. There were major local elections going on there in April of 1928. One man named Diamond Joe Esposito was running in opposition to the man that Capone wanted elected, and Diamond was outspoken about his desire for reform and change within Chicago, and Al did not want that.
Oh, boy.
Al sent his men to warn Esposito to bow out of the electoral race, but he refused. Shortly after, Diamond Esposito was gunned down in a drive-by shooting in front of his home.
Shocker.
His murder was witnessed by his bodyguards, as well as his wife and children.
Yeah, well, that's never good.
Yeah. However, when questioned by police, all of the witnesses claimed to not know who was behind the murder.
Again, shocker. Yeah, I mean, he ran that town. He ran that city. So it's like, you don't cross him. You see what happens when you cross him.
Following Esposito's murder, there were also several bombings at the homes of other candidates which dared to go against Capone's wishes.
Oh, boy.
Because of the violence involved in the election, it became national and even international news. The violence was so bad that Judge Frank Losch, who was the president of the Chicago Crime Commission, went to Capone himself to request that he control the situation as it was getting out of hand. So you have literally the president of the crime commission going to Capone and being like, hey, man, can you calm it down a bit?
Yeah, they knew who was running the streets. So
despite Capone's attempt to control the election, all of his candidates lost. It seemed that finally the people of Chicago had had enough of Al Capone's bullshit. And okay, they wanted leaders who were willing to fight against the outfit.
Wow. Okay.
Then, in December of 1928, a meeting was called in Cleveland for all of the heads of the Sicilian crime families. At this meeting, the families discussed turning the mafia into basically what it's commonly known as today. Okay. So they basically spoke about turning it into an actual organized crime syndicate within which each family owned a portion of the country and ran their own illegal operations out of that area. And none of the other families were allowed to cross into their territory.
Okay.
However, the interesting thing about this meeting was that Al Capone was not invited.
Oh, okay.
Many people assumed he was snubbed because he was not of Sicilian descent. However, regardless of his origin, the snub was especially noticeable because it was Capone who had actually invented that organizational system that these families voted in to adopt at this meeting. Some argued that Capone was left out not because of his nationality, but because the other mafia bosses felt he was too ostentatious and would bring too much attention to their illegal activities. Regardless of the reasoning behind the snub, we'll never know Capone's true feelings about it because he actually never spoke about it publicly.
Oh, wow. Okay.
During this time, Al began spending money lavishly in Miami. He took trips to Cuba, to the Bahamas. He threw lavish parties at his home on Palm Island. And in January of 1929, the Capone family had come down with a severe flu. And May called their family doctor, Dr. Kenneth Phillips. Once Al was feeling better, he invited his brother Albert, Dr. Phillips, and several bodyguards to accompany him on a boat trip to the Bahamas. After being gone for the weekend, they returned on February 14th as Al Capone had a meeting he needed to attend in Miami with a Brooklyn district attorney who'd requested to meet with Capone about the murder of Frankie Yale. So remember, in our last episode, Frankie Yale was the gangster who had owned the Harvard Club.
Okay.
He had been murdered in New York, and this district attorney wanted to speak to Capone about it. But remember, they were friends, Frankie Yale and Capone.
Right.
they had been good friends in New York, but since the spring of 1927, their relationship had deteriorated.
Oh, okay.
Frankie was a huge smuggler of whiskey, and throughout their friendship, he'd been Capone's largest supplier of whiskey. He would smuggle in whiskey from Canada and then make sure that Capone's shipments made it safely through New York and onto Chicago. However, beginning in the spring of 1927, many of these whiskey smuggling trucks began to get mysteriously hijacked in Brooklyn, which angered Capone, and he began to suspect that Frankie Yale was involved in some way. In order to determine if Frankie was indeed stealing from him, Capone asked one of his guys, a close and trusted confidant named James D'Amato, to go and spy on Frankie to make sure he had nothing to do with the hijackings. Soon after, D'Amato informed Capone that Frankie was the one behind these hijackings.
Oh, boy.
While Capone decided how to handle the situation, D'Amato was instructed to keep spying on Frankie. However, a few days following their conversation, D'Amato was outed as a spy. And in order to escape unharmed, he attempted to kill Frankie on July 1st, 1927, but he failed. As a result, Frankie ordered a hit on D'Amato, and a week later, he was gunned down in Brooklyn.
Jeez Louise.
Upon hearing this, Capone was livid and knew that he must retaliate at this point. However, at the time, he was in the midst of another gang war with a different rival mobster, so he chose to wait until it was safer for him to exact his revenge. However, Capone planned his retaliation somewhat poetically as he ordered Frankie's assassination to take place on July 1st, 1928, exactly a year to the day of D'Amato's first failed murder attempt.
Okay.
On that day, Frankie was at a club he owned known as the Sunrise Club, which was located at 14th Avenue and 65th Street. An unknown male called Frankie at the club and warned him that something was wrong with his new wife, who was at home with the couple's one-year-old daughter. Worried that someone had done something to his wife and child, Frankie ran from the club and into his brand new Lincoln Coupe, which he'd built to include bulletproof siding. As soon as Frankie took off down Utrecht Avenue, a Buick sedan pulled up alongside him at a red light. Frankie looked over and noticed that all of the Buick's occupants were armed, and as soon as the light turned green, Frankie took off through the intersection. Yale swerved onto 44th Street in an attempt to lose the Buick. However, the Buick pulled up alongside Frankie and began firing at his vehicle. Fortunately, none of the bullets made it through the bulletproof side paneling. However, Frankie's windows were not bulletproof.
Oh.
And he was struck on the left side of the head with a machine gun bullet and also with a blast from a shotgun. Frankie, of course, died instantly. His vehicle crashed into the stoop of a brownstone where it finally came to a stop. And this was actually the first time a machine gun had been used in the gang battles in New York.
The Thompson submachine gun.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
The abandoned Buick was found a few blocks away, but inside, the killers had left several weapons behind, all of which were eventually tied back to Miami by investigators, except for the Thompson submachine gun, which was actually tied back to Chicago.
Oh, and all roads lead to Capone.
Correct. Ironically, at the time of Frankie's murder, he was wearing one of the diamond-encrusted belt buckles that Capone was known for giving to his most trusted friends. It was widely known that Capone had ordered the murder, but once again, police had difficulty proving it because Capone had ordered that the guns used in the murder should be purchased under another man's name. So 6 months later, on Valentine's Day of 1929, the Brooklyn District Attorney had requested to meet with Capone to ask him a few questions about the murder, and Al had agreed. So he gets back from the Bahamas, and he immediately goes to meet with this district attorney. Because Capone knew there was no physical evidence linking him to the murder, and he could prove that he was in Miami at the time of the murder, he was cocky enough to attend the meeting without one of his attorneys. A mistake he would later regret, as he'd underestimated the intelligence of the government officials and the investigators. Capone arrived to the meeting on time. However, when he showed up to the building, he took the time to chat with reporters who were waiting outside and even posed for pictures. When he finally sauntered inside the building, he was shocked to discover that the Brooklyn District Attorney was not the only person present. Instead, a Dade County prosecutor, the the county sheriff, and a court stenographer were all present.
Oh, boy.
Despite this, Capone still sat down alone to be questioned. Once the questioning began, he was surprised to discover that none of the questions were related to the murder of Frankie Yale, but instead were about Capone's financial situation. They asked where the hotel manager, Parker Henderson, had gotten the money to purchase Capone's Palm Island property. Because remember, he had the Ponce de Leon manager buy it for him.
Right.
Capone stated, quote, "I don't remember." They then informed Capone that they knew he was receiving money from Chicago, and they wanted to know who was sending it and where the money originated from. Capone once again claimed, quote, "I don't remember." When they asked Capone if he made money from bootlegging, Capone bold-faced lied and said he'd never bootlegged a day in his life.
Okay.
Eventually, the government officials present at the meeting grew tired of Capone's evasive answers and finally asked point blank if Al's cousin, Charlie Fischetti, was the one sending Capone money from Chicago. Capone retained his composure and simply responded, quote, "What has money got to do with it?" Receiving no concrete answers from Capone, he was free to leave the building once the meeting was over. However, while this meeting was occurring, another significant event was taking place at the same time back in Chicago. While Al Capone was being questioned back in Miami, several members of Bugs Malone's Northside gang were gunned down in a garage in the Lincoln Park neighborhood in Chicago. This mass murder would eventually become infamously known as the St. Valentine's Day Massacre. In the days leading up to the massacre, the Northside gang had hijacked a shipment of Capone's Canadian whiskey. This, in conjunction with Malone's attempt to take over the outfit's dog track and several of their saloons, infuriated Capone. And it is guessed that it was this incident that led to Capone's order to have the Northside gang's leader, Bugs Malone, assassinated. While it's not completely known what exactly occurred that day, as the massacre still remains unsolved, these are the events that have been confirmed by witnesses. On February 14th, 1929, Capone planned to assassinate Bugs and several of his lieutenants within the gang. To do so, Capone enlisted the help of another Detroit gang, the Purple Gang, who lured the Northsiders to a garage with the promise of a stolen shipment of whiskey, which they offered to sell the gang for half price. At 10:30 a.m. that morning, Peter and Frank Gunsberg, Northside gang enforcers, Albert Kachalek, Moran's second in command, Adam Heyer, the Moran gang's business manager and bookkeeper, Reinhardt Schwinner, an associate of the gang, Albert Weinschenk, who managed several operations for Moran, and John May, who was just a car mechanic for the gang, all arrived at the garage. However, Bugs Moran himself was running late. Bugs Moran and one of his associates walked up to the rear of the garage via a side street. However, as they were walking up, they noticed a police car driving to the building, and they decided to turn back and hide out in a coffee shop nearby. As they made their way to the coffee shop, they ran into yet another of their gang members, Henry Gunsberg, and warned him to turn back as well. Another Northside gang member, who was also running late that day, noticed the police car before entering the garage. He ducked into a doorway and looked on from there, taking note of the police car's license plate. At this point, from a Cadillac parked in front of the garage, four men stepped out and made their way inside the garage. Two were dressed in suits and two were dressed in police uniforms and carrying shotguns. The two dressed as police officers made their way to the back of the garage where they encountered all of the Northside gang members inside. They pointed their weapons at the men and ordered them to line up along the wall, claiming they were all under arrest. The men complied, and at that point, the two officers signaled to the men in suits. The two men in suits made their way over with a pair of Thompson submachine guns and opened fire on all of the men. They unleashed all 70 rounds on the men, and then the two men dressed as officers used their shotguns to shoot both John May and James Clark directly in the face.
Oof.
In order not to spook the garage's neighbors, the two men dressed as police officers then pointed their weapons at the two men in suits who exited the buildings with their arms up to give the impression that the police had everything under control and were arresting the two men.
Okay.
When police arrived to the garage, only one of the seven men was still alive, Frank Gunsberg. who had been shot 14 times. The only other person who was alive was John May's dog. The dog's name was Highball, which I liked that.
Okay.
He'd somehow escaped the gunfire unharmed, the dog.
Okay. Well, he probably had the sense to get the hell out of there.
Yeah.
He wasn't a target, so.
Frank Gusenberg was rushed to the hospital, but refused to utter a word about who had shot him. When asked by police, he said, quote, "Nobody shot me." Unfortunately, 3 days later, Frank died from his injuries.
Yep.
So basically, Bugs Malone just got lucky that he was late that day.
He did, right. On a side note, there's an Al Capone museum in Vegas that I actually went to one of the times I was out there. And they have a portion of, it's a brick wall that they were lined up in front of in that garage. And there's actually bullet holes from the Thompson machine gun that are still into that, in that wall. And you can, you know, like take the tour of the museum and you see a portion that has that gunfire. So it was kind of weird that it was saved somehow and preserved.
Now that we've covered Al Capone, I kind of want to go to the museum.
Yeah, it's actually a cool thing. I mean, it's not, you know, nothing for kids really, because naturally it's about murder. But I enjoyed it.
So that evening, after leaving his meeting with prosecutors, Al Capone threw a huge party at his estate on Palm Island to celebrate. This massacre brought on an abrupt change in public opinion. Previously, Capone was somewhat revered as like a celebrity Robin Hood character by the public.
Right.
But once photos of the massacre were released by the press, the public was horrified. The St. Valentine's Day massacre also marked the end of law enforcement and other various government agencies' indifference to gang violence, and to Al Capone in particular. Many agencies offered rewards for any information leading to the arrest of those involved in the murders, but still, magically, no viable leads were ever uncovered.
Yeah, that's one thing. I mean, he, again, was never, as we discussed in the previous ones, he was never arrested for his actual criminality, you know, being the head of this organization, the outfit or whatever. Is like they got him because of money, financial, you know, the taxes and the evade, you know, tax evasion and stuff like that. But yeah, the massacre was a turning point for his rule over Chicago. Like a lot of people like kind of turned away and, you know, profited from him and his bribes, but that was like enough was enough. Historically, throughout time, there's always these type of incidents, whether it's the mafia or like the Hell's Angels and bikers. I know stories of that where things happen and law enforcement was like, okay, that's enough. It's like time to put a stop to it. So
at this point, government agencies began turning their attention to bootlegging as they realized this was what was funding the majority of the crime activity. Despite all of the attention now on Capone, he refused to lay low and still insisted on running business as usual. However, 3 days after the massacre, on February 17th, 1929, Capone received a subpoena requiring that he appear in court in Chicago to face a bootlegging charge. The subpoena directed Capone to appear in Chicago on March 12th before a federal grand jury. However, Capone decided to ignore the subpoena.
Bad move.
Bad move. He convinced his doctor, Dr. Phillips, to write an affidavit which swore that Capone was still suffering from, quote, bronchopneumonia pleurisy with extreme chest congestion. And that as a result, Capone had been confined to his home for the past 6 weeks. However, if you remember, Capone had just recently been partying in the Bahamas.
That's right.
And throwing parties at his house.
And the government was watching.
Which was all documented by various reporters as well. So there was pictures of it.
Right. Yeah, there was, yeah. He wasn't getting around this one.
So that affidavit was basically not fooling anyone.
Right.
After being presented with the doctor's letter, the judge denied Capone's postponement request because he basically requested to postpone the grand jury.
Right.
And the judge told Capone that he must return to Chicago by March 19th. Additionally, the U.S. Marshal charged Capone with contempt of court, as it was well documented, like we said, that he'd not been ill as he claimed.
That's right. And these are charges he's not going to be able to skirt.
Right.
Federal government, federal courts, judges, U.S. Marshals, they don't fuck around, I'm going to tell you right now.
So once Capone arrived in Chicago, he knew he'd be arrested after the hearing, and he would have to pay a $5,000 fine in order to leave jail. In true Capone fashion, he did not rush to Chicago as the judge had stipulated, and instead showed up 1 day late on March 20th.
Oh, okay.
By this point, FBI director old J. Edgar Hoover, who had previously been pretty lax about bootlegging, turned his attention to Al Capone because he saw that the Treasury Department had a legitimate way to finally catch Capone through tax evasion.
Right, exactly.
Also during this time, a woman named Mabel Walker Wilbrandt.
Okay.
She was the assistant attorney general. She became obsessed with nailing Capone as well. She was actually close friends with J. Edgar Hoover, and her whole career revolved around her fixation on enforcing prohibition. She was even given the nickname Prohibition Portia.
Prohibition Portia.
Because she was so obsessed with ending alcohol.
Well, I've never heard of her. Like, that's...
She was actually an impressive woman. She, you know, she was a big time attorney, which obviously was like pretty unheard of for a woman back then.
Yeah, I was going to say back then that wasn't the norm.
But I don't personally think we probably would have gotten along. She doesn't really seem like a good time to me.
Yeah.
I mean, she seems like kind of a stick in the mud, but, you know, more power to her.
Well, you know, those focused A-type personalities that do those type of jobs that are like kind of, I don't want to say overzealous, but they're zealous about their work and stuff. Like, they're usually pretty much loners for the most part, like, you know, just because of the way their mind works and the way that they act and stuff. So I would probably think that that's probably why she just, you know, wouldn't be a party favorite.
I'm sorry, but she's trying to end alcohol. Girl, I ain't about it. I mean, you know, more power to you. You paved the way for women, but calm down and have a drink.
Have a drink and relax. I get it. But it was against the law back then. So,
however, despite how boring she may have been,
yeah,
Mabel was incredibly intelligent, and she was known as the quote possessor of one of the keenest legal minds.
Wow. Okay.
Supposedly, Mabel became so obsessed with catching Capone because she, quote, was so incensed by what she believed was Dr. Phillips' false and flippant affidavit. She sternly believed that both Capone and Dr. Phillips should be severely punished for lying so obviously to the court. It became obvious to Mabel that bootlegging was difficult to prove, and she realized that the best way to catch these criminals was to focus on their financial dealings, as these bootleggers frequently claimed to have no income but flaunted incredible wealth. Right. While this idea seems pretty obvious to us today, back then it was unprecedented. So when Mabel presented this idea to her colleagues, they thought it genius, but also, quote, completely insane.
Right. Yeah. As a lot of people think of their, again, overzealous employees or employers or whatever.
Therefore, as soon as it was made evident to her that Capone and his doctor were clearly lying to the court about Capone's supposed illness, she wrote to her good friend J. Edgar Hoover, telling him of her desire to nail Al Capone legally. In her letter to him, she wrote it was, quote, a personal matter of great importance, and that she wished to punish both Capone and his doctor, quote, secretly and soon.
Yeah, I mean, she made it, you know, which you're not really supposed to do. She made it personal, like a personal
vendetta.
No, personal objective, which, I mean, historically in law enforcement, you're not supposed to take it personally because, you know, you have to remain unbiased and, you know, and be fair and equal and stuff. But, you know, some of the greatest prosecutors and some of the greatest law enforcement agents and, you know, officers and stuff, they take it personally. It almost consumes them and, you know, becomes their life. So
it consumed her for sure.
Yeah. So it's kind of a, you know, it's a positive thing in the sense that they get a lot accomplished and do well, but on the negative side, it, you know, again, it consumes them and that's their whole place in life. He's definitely the candidate for one of these overzealous, you know, prosecutors or, you know, investigators, whatever. But for her personal well-being or whatever, it consumed her, I'm sure. And, you know.
So when J. Edgar Hoover received Mabel's letter, he contacted President Herbert Hoover. So up till this point, President Hoover had been reluctant to enforce prohibition, as he stated alcohol was, quote, a vehicle of joy that could not be generally suppressed by federal law.
My man.
I know. I was like, man, President Hoover, you sound like a good time. Unlike Mabel, he was a grand old time.
Well, you know, the reality of it is, I mean, yes, there's a lot of negatives for alcohol, but, you know, a lot of people enjoy it. So,
yeah, you know. I mean, as long as you're drinking responsibly, you know what I mean?
Absolutely. Like, as long as you're not driving around killing people, I mean, but there's a responsible way to do it. And I think it's fun, but, you know. I enjoy it.
Despite Hoover's lax stance on prohibition, he was well aware of the quickly spreading lawlessness that had taken over Chicago. By 1929, Hoover realized that he had no choice but to do something about it, and he directed all federal agencies to, quote, concentrate upon Mr. Capone and his allies. He agreed with Mabel that it would be difficult to convict Capone based upon his criminal activities alone, so he followed Mabel's advice and instructed everyone to focus on Capone's refusal to pay federal taxes. He placed the Secretary of the Treasury, Andrew Mellon, in charge of the investigation. Ironically, Andrew Mellon was known to be a heavy drinker despite prohibition.
Doesn't make him a bad person.
He was another good time. Good time, Charlie.
You know, they took away something that a majority of the people did. Like, that was, it's not like they had internet and stuff to occupy their time.
I'm glad I didn't live back then, man.
It was a difficult time back then, so.
President Hoover was later quoted pointing out the irony of the situation, saying how unbelievable it was that, quote, a man guilty of inciting hundreds of murders, in some of which he took a personal hand, had to be punished merely for failure to pay taxes on the money he had made by murder.
Yeah.
When Capone finally showed up to court on March 20th, 1929, because remember, he showed up a day late.
Right.
He was questioned about his financial endeavors, but was then released and free to cavort around Chicago. He had to pay his $5,000 fine, and then he was free to go.
Okay.
At the same time Capone was being summoned to face the grand jury, he also discovered that one of the heads of a rival gang had placed a $50,000 bounty on his head.
Oh.
Which, for the time, a lot of money.
A lot of money.
Capone's personal bodyguard, Frankie Rio, who was also one of his best friends, heard of the assassination request through the gangland Grapevine and immediately informed Capone. It quickly came to light that two of the outfit's own assassins, Albert Anselmi and John Galisi, had accepted the assignment from a man named Joseph Giunta.
Giunta, okay.
He was known as Hop Toad Giunta.
Hop Toad Giunta?
That was his name.
All right, use that in a sentence.
Oh, Hop Toad.
Hop Toad. Hot with a T or hop, like hopping?
Hop, like hop pop.
Oh, shit. All right.
So, oh, Hop Toad was the newly elected president of the rival gang Union Siciliana.
Oh, the Sicilian Union.
Yeah.
Probably what it translates to, right?
Yeah.
Look at that. I don't even speak Italian. Hey.
Oh, there you go.
Forget about it.
Capone was livid that his own men would plot his murder and ordered Frankie Rio, the same bodyguard who told him about the murder plot, to, quote, take care of all three men involved.
Take care of it, baby.
Capone explained to Frankie that he wanted their deaths to be particularly violent as a warning to all other gangs and to his own men that he was not to be messed with. Although the details of what occurred are unknown to this day, the three men were eventually discovered in their own vehicle in Hammond, Indiana. The men had been severely beaten and then riddled with bullets. Their bodies were left in their own vehicle, and then the vehicle was set on fire.
Ooh, all right.
Only a month following his appearance in court and the murder of his men, Capone was once again back in Miami partying with other crime families, which he was on good terms with. From May 13th through the 16th of 1929, Al attended a mob boss convention in Atlantic City, where all of the bosses once again met to agree on territories, because, you know, they were always going against it.
A mob boss convention. That's...
Yeah. And what's crazy is everybody knew this was going on. Like, it was like a legit convention. Like, the FBI was there. They knew it was happening. Like,
I'm sure they were photographing everybody coming in and out. And
oh, yeah. It was in the papers. Wow. It wasn't like a secret.
Right. That's crazy.
Because they all were constantly worried about being bugged by the FBI, the only way the crime bosses would discuss anything with one another was to walk in small groups along the boardwalk in Atlantic City. So instead of being in like a conference room, they would have to go out on the boardwalk and like discuss as they walked.
And I'm sure they had like their hands over their mouths. And
oh, yeah. Once again, terms were agreed upon, and once again, they were not truly adhered to for very long. However, Capone knew that he was the target of many rival gangs during this time. There was still a $50,000 reward out for his murder. Frankie Yale's men, they still wanted retribution for his murder.
Right.
as well as every other gangster who just wanted in on his territory.
Of course, right.
As a result, Capone thought it would be wise to lay low for a while after leaving Atlantic City, and he formulated a plan. He decided that after leaving Atlantic City, he would secretly make his way to Philadelphia, where he would orchestrate a stunt in order to get himself arrested. He would commit a crime that would only get him a few months in jail, where he could lay low until other gangs were no longer looking to murder him. And he hoped his short stint in jail would also assuage the feds who were after him, because since he was arrested, they'd, you know, move on and look into other crimes and other criminals.
Yeah, which they did not.
No. So Capone hired policeman James Shuey Malone.
These names.
Imagine if it's people. Hey, Shuey.
Shuey Malone. All right.
He hired Shuey Malone to wait for he and his bodyguard, Frankie Rio, to exit a movie theater. From there, Officer Malone searched them both and magically found illegal weapons in their possession.
Oh, my goodness.
Rumor has it that Capone paid Malone and his partner $10,000 each to arrest him, but this has never been officially verified.
Oh, okay.
While Capone was relieved to be in the safety of police custody, he quickly realized he'd underestimated the amount of time he and Frankie would have to spend in prison. He'd believed it would only be up to a month, but following his court hearing in May of 1929, he and Frankie were actually sentenced to a full year behind bars in one of the worst prisons in Pennsylvania, Holmesburg Prison. Capone and Frankie stayed in Holmesburg for 3 months until Capone was somehow able to pull some strings and was transferred to Philadelphia Eastern State Penitentiary, which was a much nicer prison, and the warden treated Capone like a king. He allowed Capone's wife, May, to ship fancy furniture to the prison. So his entire cell was decked out in rugs, couches. She even sent a state-of-the-art radio, which Capone played loud enough for all the inmates around him to enjoy as well in order to gain their trust and devotion. He also provided their families with money, all in an effort to gain their protection while he was there. The warden even allowed Capone to wear his own clothes, including silk pajamas and tailored suits.
Unreal, man.
While in prison, the inmates' visitors were supposed to be restricted. However, this was not the case for Al, and many of his trusted lieutenants and employees came and went as they pleased, so he was still able to run the outfit from prison.
Wow.
He even arranged to have local restaurants cook and deliver his daily meals, as he refused to eat the meals prepared at the prison. He and the warden became such good friends during his stay that the warden would check Al out of prison and bring him home to have dinner at his house. And then, and they would have dinner and drinks together. And then after, he would just return him to his cell for the night.
That shit don't happen now.
Capone also made sure that his most trusted bodyguard, Frankie, because he went to jail with him, he made sure that Frankie enjoyed many of the same perks in his cell as well. The only small hiccup that Capone experienced while in prison was the removal of his tonsils, which had gotten severely infected during his stay. Finally, on March 17, 1930, Al and Frankie were both released 2 months early as a result of good behavior. However, unlike Capone hoped, the long stay in prison did nothing to deter the feds from proceeding with their tax evasion case. And they informed Al that following his release, he must make his way to Chicago and appear in court only 3 days later on March 20th, 1930, this time on charges of tax evasion. However, prior to appearing in court, Capone was made aware that Chicago's deputy police commissioner, John Stege, was hoping to arrest Capone as soon as he arrived in Chicago because he wanted to question him in the St. Valentine's Day murders, as they still remained unsolved, and he was hoping to catch Capone before the feds could.
Wow, okay.
Stege ordered every police officer to be on the lookout for Capone and even placed officers at his home and his known associate's home. Capone did not want to be questioned in relation to the murders, and he said he had no problem with the, quote, federal inquisition into his tax activity, but would not subject himself to, quote, grilling by them ignorant coppers.
Okay.
So Capone hid within a hotel known as the Western. Finally, as he did not appear for his scheduled court appearance because he's hiding out in the Western, federal treasury agent Elliot Ness ordered that wiretaps be placed in Capone's family home in Chicago, also in his brother Ralph's hotel room, and many of the various speakeasies that Ralph ran in order to discover where Capone was hiding out. Finally, one evening, Capone had drank himself into a rage and was throwing such a tantrum that one of Ralph's men called him and begged him to come pick up Capone because they were having difficulty dealing with him in his drunken stupor. The feds picked up Ralph's men saying, quote, "You're the only one who can handle him when he gets like this." He also explained that Capone was smashing furniture and he had somehow badly burned his hand. When Capone had sobered up, he decided he was done with hiding and made his way to the Chicago Police Commissioner's office on March 21st, 1930, where he confronted John Stege. Capone brought both his lawyer and a photographer along with him. Stege, although surprised to see Capone, took advantage of the situation and demanded to know if he'd been involved in the St. Valentine's Day massacre. Capone denied any involvement, of course, and claimed he couldn't be held responsible for every killing in Chicago. Capone was confident that Stege had no evidence of his involvement and boldly stated that he hoped that now that he'd spoken to him, that he would cease harassing him and his family in Chicago. As Al turned to leave, Stege reportedly shouted at Capone, quote, "Your luck has run out," and then asked when he planned on leaving Chicago. Capone calmly told Stege that he would be returning to his wife in Miami soon. Stege responded that the next time Al found himself in Chicago, he would be there to arrest him. Capone's lawyer stated that arrests without cause could not happen within the United States, and even in Russia, Lenin and Trotsky had rebelled against them. In response, Stege shouted, "I hope Capone goes to Russia." Capone merely laughed at him and left.
Wow. Was Stege Russian?
No, he was just talking shit, I think.
Okay, all right. I was going to say, like, why the Russian angle all of a sudden, but...
However, as it turned out, the tide had indeed turned against Al, even in Miami. As 2 days before, on March 19th, the governor of Florida ordered that Capone's mansion be raided. The police uncovered illegal liquor and arrested all of the men present, but Capone himself was still in Chicago. As a result, the Florida governor ordered police throughout the state to keep an eye out for Capone and instructed them to arrest him the minute he re-entered Florida. However, Al's lawyers in Florida argued that the governor had no power to keep Al from his home without any evidence that the liquor had been his. And ultimately, a federal judge agreed, and the governor was forced to withdraw his order.
Oh.
During this time, the feds also brought charges against Capone's brother Ralph and fellow outfit member Frank Needy, who had also been committing tax evasion. Ultimately, Ralph was found guilty and was sentenced to 3 years in prison and was charged a $10,000 fine. And Frank Needy was also found guilty and sentenced to serve time in Leavenworth Prison. These seemed to be a warm-up for the trial, which was about to begin against Capone. Due to Al Capone's legal troubles and his absence while in prison, Johnny Torrio, the old leader of the outfit, came out of retirement and once again began leading the outfit. When it became clear that the federal government was attempting to charge Capone for tax evasion, Torrio became worried that the government would be successful, especially after the conviction of Al's brother and Frank Needy. However, despite their convictions on the same charge, Capone did not seem worried. He explained to Torrio that he'd always been wise with keeping the outfit's financials separate from his own personal financials. He assured Torrio that there was no physical records linking him to any profit the outfit had brought in over the years. He only received income through third-party checks in others' names. He paid for everything in cash as to leave no paper trail, and all of his assets, including both of his homes, were in other people's names. Despite Capone's assurances, Torrio demanded that he start formulating a defense against the feds' indictments, and he instructed him to hire his own personal tax lawyer, Lawrence P. Mattingly. Capone did as he was directed. Mattingly explained to Capone that his best defense would be to admit to the IRS that he actually had earned an income in the past, although it was illegal. From there, Mattingly believed he could formulate a deal with prosecutors that would allow Capone to pay his back taxes as well as a fine for having not paid in the past. And having paid both of those things, he'd be able to walk away without the threat of criminal prosecution. As at this time, the federal government rarely wished to extend the time or the energy taking individuals to court for unpaid taxes, especially when they were able and willing to pay what they owed. While this was generally a good plan that most likely would have worked for any other individual, Mattingly failed to take into account that his client was Al Capone, and the Bureau was determined to put him behind bars. Capone finally came out of hiding at the end of March 1930 and began to brazenly make his way around Chicago. At this point, the Bureau contacted Mattingly and demanded that he come to the offices in Chicago and bring Capone with him. Mattingly asked for a continuance due to his defending another client in court at the time, and a judge granted the continuance, stating that he must produce Capone by April 17, 1930. After hiding from authorities for over a month, Capone, accompanied by his attorney, finally showed up to the Bureau's offices on the morning of April 17th as directed. Once there, both Mattingly and Capone sat down with agent C.W. Herrick, who began questioning Capone. He began his questioning by stating something similar to a Miranda warning, although during this time, the Miranda warning did not yet exist in its entirety as it does today. Right. However, agent Herrick clearly informed Capone that anything he said, quote, could be used and would probably be used against him. It was at this point that Mattingly should have instructed Capone to not answer anything further and leave the premises. However, that is not what occurred.
Ooh, okay.
Instead, Mattingly informed the investigator that Capone wished to fully cooperate with the investigation, but he would not be admitting any guilt, and he requested that anything Capone said be kept off the record, a request that Agent Herrick ignored. Capone was asked questions about his income and where it came from. He was also asked about his properties, all of his banking accounts, if he owned horses, participated in dog racing, and if he had access to any safety deposit boxes. For the majority of these questions, Capone answered either no or, quote, I would rather let my lawyer answer that question. However, according to the interview transcript, Mattingly did not actually answer any questions that were deferred to him by Capone and never instructed Capone whether to answer or not to answer any specific questions he was asked. In other words, Mattingly did a really shitty job as an attorney.
Good job, yeah.
Although that's all that's contained in the actual transcript of the interview, some experts believe that Capone was questioned further after the official interview ended, as some witnesses who worked within the Bureau at the time have since claimed that they were present when further questioning ensued.
Oh, okay.
But there's no record of that.
Okay.
After the questioning was complete, Mattingly finally offered investigators a deal. He offered to hand over an estimate of Capone's income if investigators would then agree on a settlement his client could pay in order to avoid jail time. The investigators initially agreed and requested that Mattingly turn over the income documentation within 3 weeks. However, for some unexplained reason, Mattingly did not turn this documentation over until 7 months later, in November of 1930. When Mattingly finally did send over the documents, he stated in his cover letter that once again, what was within the documents were not an admission of guilt on Capone's end. However, it was immediately apparent to investigators that the content within the documents was all bullshit. Mattingly claimed that until the end of 1926, Capone had only made $75 per week, which he claimed was a meager sum considering he was supporting his entire family on only $75 a week.
Okay, right.
It was immediately and obviously apparent to investigators that it was simply impossible that Capone had been able to support 6 people and afford 2 homes on an income of that size. However, Mattingly attempted to explain this away by suggesting that between 1926 and 1929, Al and 3 other, quote, associates began a business which made, quote, considerable sums of money. But despite this, Mattingly claimed that Capone was never, quote, the banker for the organization. So therefore, he never invested capital into the company and was not entitled to the entirety of its profits. Mattingly was vague about the nature of the business, only stating that Capone himself had never, quote, actively participated in the conduct of its individual enterprises.
Okay.
So he was basically saying he's involved in illegal activity, but...
Well, right, he's not.
Right.
But he had nothing to do with it.
He claimed that Capone's income grew from 1925 to 1929 as a result of this quote-unquote business, but claimed that Capone only made $26,000 in 1925, $40,000 in 1926, and $100,000 in both 1928 and 1929. The federal government was not buying it.
Bullshit.
Yeah. Deirdre Baer states in her book, quote, how the lawyer could have thought such a letter would benefit his client has boggled the minds of many other lawyers who have studied Al Capone's legal woes. Also, although Mattingly began his letter asking that nothing within the letter be legally used against his client, It was evident to investigators that Mattingly should have known that, in fact, the investigators could most certainly use anything within the letter against his client, especially considering that within the many meetings Mattingly had had with various investigators, the investigators had repeatedly informed Mattingly that anything he stated or wrote, quote, would be used if necessary or advisable by the government in a criminal prosecution against the taxpayer. However, while Mattingly's letter did solidify for investigators that Capone was in fact a member of an illegal crime organization, it still did not provide any concrete links between Capone and any of the outfit's operations. Okay. So I personally think this is just my guess. I think that Mattingly, for whatever reason, purposely was being a bad attorney.
Yeah, he might have gotten talked to, or somebody got to him from the federal government, or.
Yeah, I don't know if it was just like, oh, I know he's a bad guy and I kind of secretly want him arrested, or if it was like, I mean, because he was Torrio's lawyer too. So I wonder if maybe Torrio was like, listen, botch this case because I want him out, but this is the only way to do it and look right. good about it.
Yeah, and not be blamed for it, or
because something's okay, not adding sense. Up.
You're right. You're no, absolutely right. That's straight up, I mean, blatant ineffective counsel. Like, no good attorney would allow him to do, especially at the level that they're at, because of, you know, what he's done and who he is. There's definitely something going on there for sure.
Because Capone was distracted by his legal troubles, Joe Alio, Capone's old rival who led the Union Siciliana, believed it would be a good time to once again put a hit out on Capone. Capone, upon hearing this, immediately ordered his own hit on Alio, and on October 23rd, 1930, he was murdered. Alio was leaving a friend's apartment and making his way to the barber shop when machine gun fire erupted from a second floor window in the building across the street. Alio was shot 13 times before he finally fell off the apartment's front steps. Alio struggled to get out of the line of fire and was attempting to make it around a corner when a second gunman began firing from a third floor window in another apartment building.
Wow.
Following the murder, two men were seen running from the building. They jumped into a Ford sedan and took off. Alio was taken to a nearby hospital, but was ultimately pronounced dead. He was shot over 59 times.
Jesus.
The murderers were never caught.
Shocker.
Yeah. Finally, on February 25th, 1931, Capone's trial for his charge of contempt of court from his refusal to show up for his 1929 subpoena finally began. The trial was overseen by Judge James H. Wilkerson, and no jury was present as Capone was simply there to explain to the judge why he'd ignored the subpoena. Capone and his attorneys once again maintained that Capone had been too ill with the flu to appear. The prosecution showed evidence that Capone was in actuality gallivanting around Miami and the Bahamas at the time, as there were photographs of Capone at expensive restaurants, at racetracks, and boarding private planes during this period. Capone's doctor, Dr. Phillips, was called to testify, and under heavy cross-examination, finally admitted that what he'd written in the letter about Al's illness was not accurate. He stated that he'd only written the letter at the insistence of Capone and his attorney. He admitted under oath that he was terrified of Al and his brothers and was too afraid to refuse. It is no surprise that following this testimony, Judge Wilkerson ultimately found Capone guilty and sentenced Capone to serve 6 months in the county jail. However, rather than serve his time, Capone paid $5,000 bail and remained free while his attorneys filed appeals. Though Capone remained free for now, the federal agents who had him under surveillance for tax evasion took careful note of the fact that he was able to come up with $5,000 in bail at the drop of a hat.
Mm-hmm. Where's this money coming from?
Correct. Because he only makes like 75 a week.
Yeah. It's garbage.
4 months later, on June 5th, 1931, a federal grand jury finally indicted Al Capone on 24 separate counts of non-payment of income taxes based on an income of $1,038,654.84, of which Capone owed $215,080.48 in back taxes.
Yeah.
As it turned out, the Bureau of Internal Revenue had a plethora of evidence against Capone. They had threatened several of the outfit's bookkeepers with severe jail time if they did not agree to testify against Capone, and many agreed under the promise of witness protection. Additionally, the Bureau had collected tons of evidence from various wiretaps and one agent had even gone undercover and infiltrated the outfit and was able to testify as to what he'd experienced while there.
Wow.
By the time Capone was arrested, the amount of evidence compiled against him was so large that agents had to request permission to relocate to bigger offices in order to contain the over 2,000 documents pertaining to Capone's case.
Wow.
Investigators had even gotten their hands on several of the outfit's ledgers, which contained Al's initials and proved that Al was making far more per year than he had reported to the IRS. All of this evidence was not enough on its own, but together it sealed Capone's fate. And following his trial on October 24th, 1931, Judge Wilkerson sentenced Capone to 11 years in prison, and he was required to pay fines and court costs of $57,692.29, which today would equate to about $935,192.
Wow, that's a lot, almost $1 million.
Yeah.
Jesus.
Following Capone's arrest, he was unable to continue running the outfit, and his longtime friend, Frank Needy, took over when he got out of prison. Because remember, he got arrested for tax evasion as well.
Right.
Frank Needy arguably ran the outfit in a much less ostentatious way than Capone had, and they did not receive as much police scrutiny, and the amount of unchecked violence subsided substantially.
Imagine that.
The mafia as a whole also became much less conspicuous following the end of Prohibition. Although, despite their secrecy, it was determined by the FBI in the 1950s that the outfit still reigned supreme within Chicago at that time as the number one gang. Mm. In 1939, Capone became severely ill, and it was revealed that he was suffering from syphilitic paresis.
Right. Syphilis.
Yeah. Yeah, he had a PP disease.
That's what got him.
It is what got him.
All the shit that he did, that's what got him.
So that's karma right there. So syphilitic paresis is a disorder which occurs in those who contract syphilis and do not receive treatment for it. In its late stages, syphilis causes the brain to basically atrophy. So between 10 and 30 years after contracting the disease, it slowly begins essentially eating away at the brain, and the person will eventually develop symptoms similar to dementia.
Yeah, basically just eat your brain away. Well, your brain just kind of dies.
Yeah. Given the severity of Capone's condition, he was released from prison early on November 16, 1939, after only serving a little less than 8 years. Upon leaving, Capone attempted to seek treatment at Johns Hopkins Hospital in Baltimore, but was refused treatment due to his criminal past. So the doctors were like, we're not treating you.
Wow.
I know. Yeah, I don't think that that's like would be allowed today.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I guess
they have their oath and stuff that they have to adhere to.
Yeah.
So he was forced to seek treatment elsewhere. And finally, Union Memorial Hospital agreed to treat him. He stayed there for 3 weeks before deciding to return home to his Palm Island mansion.
Right.
3 years later, penicillin began being mass produced in the United States, and Capone began treatment with that new drug.
Right.
While this did not completely eradicate the disease as it was already too advanced, it did help slow it down.
Yeah, like prolonged his life. So,
right. So by 1946, Capone's doctors concluded that his brain had deteriorated so much that he now only had the mentality of a 12-year-old boy.
Yep.
A year later, on January 21st, 1947, Capone suffered a stroke from which he never recovered. And after contracting bronchial pneumonia, his heart failed on January 25th, 1947.
After that episode, he was confined to a wheelchair. And then shortly thereafter, like it just, his body just started shutting down and his mind, you know, going bad and everything. That's,
which to me, that's one of the worst ways to go, to like slowly lose your mental capability.
Yeah.
And so to me, I'm like, that was, call it God, call it karma, whatever. To me, I was like, you got what you deserved in the end.
Did he?
I mean, you could always say he deserved more for sure.
Oh, no, yeah. I mean, it's pretty bad, but for sure he deserved, you know, everything that he got. But, you know, I don't know. That is a sucky way to go. You just become kind of like a fucking blob of jello, I guess. I mean, I don't know. Like, I definitely wouldn't want to fucking go that way. That's for sure.
Me either. So we have a question. So this question's actually for me. So you don't have to say anything.
Okay. I'm going to interrupt abruptly just because.
So this is from Kim. So hi, Kim.
Hello, Kim. Thanks for not involving me in the question.
Okay. So this is her question.
Or am I?
I don't think you're kidding. I think you're a little jealous.
I am very jealous.
So Kim said, I was wondering how much time you invest researching a story on average. Is it mostly internet search, calling, and do you ever travel to where the crime took place? So Kim, the answer to that is I spend a lot of time. I kind of end up always going down a rabbit hole and I always end up doing more than I think I'm going to do. But it really depends on the case. Some cases obviously have way more information, so they take a lot longer. For example, Capone, that took forever because like I've been working on this one for a very long time because there's so much information out there. And I have to like first research it all, then decide what's important enough to keep in. And because if I were to keep everything in, it would be like 8 million episodes.
Awkward interruption.
So rude.
Rude. Sorry.
But it depends. Like some cases that don't have as much information out there, obviously it takes me a little bit shorter, but I would say each one, if I had to put like an average on it, probably at least takes me 10 hours to investigate everything. Obviously that can be less sometimes and sometimes more. Capone definitely took me more than that for sure. You just get to sit on your pretty little butt and listen.
0.0 hours.
I do.
I investigate too much and I don't want to do it anymore.
Yeah. I think if I were you, I'd prefer to just.
Listen, I enjoy investigations and, you know, it's what I do. But I like the fact that I don't know what we're going to talk about. And sometimes I learn something new. Sometimes it's something I've heard about. And I like this dynamic.
But to answer your second question.
What was the second? Do you ever go? Yeah.
Yeah. Mostly it depends, obviously, once again, on the case. Like, some cases, you know, there's books about it. So I'll read, for example, Capone, like I read books on him. It was some internet searching, you know, I'll look up articles. I'll look up court documents if they're available. Some cases you can find a lot of that, which is interesting, which obviously that gives the most accurate information. I also will watch if obviously this is for newer cases, but I'll watch the video from court if it's available, which it usually is now, obviously. I'll even watch interrogation videos if they're available. So I have seen certain crime scenes, but I wouldn't say that I travel like specifically for the research of it. But just like if I'm in a city and I'm familiar with something, like just out of my own curiosity, I'll go see it.
Yeah,
like,
we go by. Yeah, go by and see it.
For example, when I was in LA, I went to the Cecil Hotel because I just wanted to see it. It's closed down, so I couldn't go in, but I, you know, took pictures of it from the outside and stuff. But yeah, so to answer your question, that's pretty much mostly what I do, you know,
but that might be something fun, like in the future, if we get to a level where.
Yeah, I would love to be able to do that. Yeah, if we could.
So, yeah, I'm down.
Well, you know that we're going to start our private investigation firm, so we'll be traveling then.
I'm going to be very busy when I retire.
Yeah, you know, you just got to knuckle down.
Yeah, I just want to hang out with my grandkids and my children. That's it.
Don't worry, that's on the list too. That's on the list too.
All right.
So yeah, that closes up
our question.
That's a good question. It closes up our Al Capone.
Capone has been put to rest.
Yeah, fuck him.
The pee-pee disease got him.
All right. Well, until next time. Bye.
Bye. One second.